Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. What I'd like to do, we have talked a lot about the children. But we haven't talked about the relationships at all. And as Natasha so wisely said, when the kids are gone, you're going to just have each other. And I think that's important. So I put Natasha on the spot to come up with a good 30, 45 minutes of leading a discussion. My biggest question is, how to get a disbeliever to be empathetic with the perspective of a believer and vice versa. And I don't know where you guys, if you guys are all there and you've nailed that, what I tend to think is that in the way that this discussion has been going, there's a lot of believers thinking, this makes me really uncomfortable. I don't know how I'm ever going to feel comfortable with my spouse. And I know that the disbelievers are suffering with similar things, reciprocal. So I'm going to give Natasha some time to address these things. But before I do, I want to address Paul's question before we move on. So,
okay, well, I think my comment was going to be along the lines of where you're going. I was just making an observation that, if you had two marriages where one marriage was a Presbyterian and a Lutheran and they went to church, you know, at the scale of American norms, and which is not that often, you know, the issues of what's the nature of the Trinity are not going to be stressful in the marriage, right? And if you had, on the other extreme, a marriage where it's, you know, Orthodox Muslim raised an educated madrasa with an Orthodox Jew, then religious issues are going to be extremely stressful, you know, when it comes to observing, you know, the use of electricity on the Sabbath and so forth. And so I guess my observation is what I keep hearing in terms of how do you cope with this issue or that issue as a couple is try and find ways to be less dogmatic. Because the more hardcore you are in your belief and firm you are in non-negotiables about your faith, the more you're going to have a stressful situation in the marriage when you don't agree on that point. I just want to make the observation comment. I actually would be curious to see how this concept plays out as we start talking about navigating the couple issues later.
The only thing I'll say is that in an Orthodox religious perspective, dogmatism is a virtue, right? So that's difficult, and I'll tell you that within the culture of some ex-Mormon communities, it is the same.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think you can be dogmatic on both sides, and I think to the extent that both partners in the marriage are able to sort of relax about the dogmatic aspects of their belief systems, you'll have less tension and stress. But there may be a value disconnect in doing so. I mean, to ask someone who is a core, hardcore, believing Mormon to relax on the whole, you know, the prophet said we need to follow this guidance is a value disconnect. And likewise, if someone is an ex-Mormon who feels very strongly that they were lied to, you know, the whole don't worry about the kids going and hearing this message can also be a huge value disconnect. And I think that even if you had willingness to be less dogmatic in the marriage, you would still face this struggle to say whether you're comfortable or okay from a moral standpoint with making those compromises.
Holly, do you have
the issue of having empathy for the other person's position, and you know, I mean, I have been a disbeliever for over two decades, and I haven't had to deal with it with a spouse, but I have dealt with it with my family of origin a great deal. And there are ways, of course, in which, I mean, my mother was buried on Good Friday. My mother died in March, and everybody was so upset. It was going to ruin Easter for us. And I was the one, I'm, you know, the atheist who said, "Oh, come on, you guys. Mom's being buried on Good Friday. Can you think of a better day in the entire calendar for Mom to be buried?" You know, it worked out okay for Jesus. And, you know, I don't even believe in the resurrection, but I was the one who had to point this out to them. And you know, but one of the reasons it's hard when you're on the other side is you know how they talk about you because you've heard, you've been part of conversations where you talk about Uncle Johnny and where you talk. And so the you know what really gets said about people like you. And so, yeah, you can think back, well, this is how I felt. This is what it was like to feel this way, and I know this is important to them, and it helps them, and blah, 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 blah. But you still know that there's a way in which empathy for you is not a value or a virtue. It is, again, a threat. And you think, well, why should I extend to these people something they don't want and seem unwilling to give to me?
Good stuff. All right, Natasha. I'm going to let that be kind of the segue to introduce you, and I'm going to trust you that you will give Holly her fair consideration and Paul as we kind of try and navigate this. Is that all right?
Meaning the two people that just
yes.
spoke? Okay.
Gosh, there's just so many things that I would love to talk about, of course, and there's so many different situations, and I could spend, I'm sure, hours with, you know, each one of you individually or as a couple discussing all the nuances of each individual situation, because although we speak in generics in a conference like this and kind of general ways that maybe can be helpful, I know that there are specifics to each situation that sometimes there are exceptions to the rule, and there are even maybe exceptions to what I present at this time. So, of course, my general offering to you today will be helpful at some level, but it may not be helpful, you know, in a totality. Saying that, I'll get started on kind of, I started thinking, we're talking almost exclusively about parenting, which, of course, is a huge concern for all of us. We want to be good parents. But the heart of any good parenting relationship, good parenting relationship is usually a marital or at least a co-parenting relationship. So whether or not you're divorced or not, you still can offer a co-parenting relationship to your children, which is of extreme value and more valuable, really, than most things, other things that you can offer them. So I want to talk about what I like to call the four intimacies. And I'm sorry, I'm visual, so you'll just have to put up with my... But I see, and this is just, there's no research to back me up here. This is just kind of something I've come up with. But I see people having, first of all, we like to think of intimacy as just sex, and I'm not in that camp. So intimacy for me is physical, spiritual, all these other things. So I see one area of intimacy that we share with our spouse is that being emotional. And then another one is intellectual, and another one is spiritual, and then another one is physical. So those are the kind of four. And I'm not saying that there can't be more things added to this, but this in general, I think, is where most people are connecting with one another. And I think the healthier marriages tend to do a good job of balancing out these four areas of your relationship. I think, unfortunately, in Orthodox religion, or traditional religion, we tend to rely on this one a whole lot. So we may not have maybe a great sex life, and we might not even really talk about anything that's intellectual or share any ideas. We may share some feelings, but we go to church every week together, and we have a shared value system together, and we know how we're going to raise our kids, and a lot of your value as a couple can be based on this one area. So when that's stripped away for whatever reason, then you're left feeling like you have nothing. And so what I have found useful in working with couples with faith crisis issues is to really start looking at where are you in these other three areas and how do you redefine your spiritual intimacy. So in other words, not that it needs to be completely at a zero now because you have different ideas of who Joseph Smith is, but how are you going to recreate a different definition? And I guess what I'm saying at some level can also be true for family members, because I know you brought up like extended family, And not that we share physical intimacy with our extended family, but we do share a lot of these other intimacies with our families. And so it can be useful maybe in some kind of abstract way in that sense. So emotional intimacy is how good are we at sharing our feelings, our thoughts, our day, you know, just kind of, and how do we, when we have emotions, so whether it's anger or sadness, especially in the emotions that are difficult to deal with. I mean, it's always easy to hang out with somebody who's happy, I guess. But happy is there too, and content, all these emotions. When we're feeling these ways, how do we relate as a couple? So in other words, can we share anger in our relationship and still feel safe? Can we share sadness in our relationship and still feel safe? Or if we share these types of feelings, does it somehow wipe away some type of foundation? Our intellectual intimacy is our ideas. Some of this can correlate with spiritual in the sense of, for many, the journey out of the LDS church is an intellectual one. You know, you're reading books, you're finding out new information. But it doesn't have to be just religious ideas. It can be politics. It can be, what's going on in the world, what's going on in our community. Are we able to talk to each other about these kinds of things? Do we know what we think about these kinds of things? Do we automatically, my husband's a Republican, so I guess I am too, kind of thing? Or do we formulate our own kind of ideas about these things and talk about them? And when we don't agree, what's that like? Okay, is it safe to not agree on these ideas or not? Spiritual, obviously, is kind of this idea of common values. And many times that is having the same religion, but sometimes it isn't. And you can still have spiritual intimacy without being in the same religion. And of course, physical intimacy is our sexuality. It's our sensuality. It's things like massage. It's things like, are we comfortable holding hands? Are we comfortable showing affection? So it's not just sex. These kind of four areas of our lives kind of start giving us a more holistic view to our relationships. Does this resonate with anybody? So one thing that, I would encourage you, if you're struggling in your marriage right now because of the faith in crisis, I think that this is a very important thing to start looking at, is where are our strengths? Where do we do well? And where do we maybe not do so well? And start assessing what is it that we need to focus on. Okay? Any questions about this or any comments, or anybody want to share any experiences around it? Yes.
Thank you. I think one of the questions I have, we're really new to all of this. We're new to everything. We're new parents. We've only been married for 3 years, and now we're new to this religion thing, with conflict. And something that I'm supposed to be the believer, but something that I am struggling with is I don't really know what to expect, because I know John mentioned, like, for a while you're in a really dark place, and it seems like there's this whole process of you go from believing, then you start investigating things, and you become a non-believer, then you're really angry and bitter, and I'm just waiting, like, okay, what's after this? It's really scary for me, and I feel like the four intimacies you've talked about, like, I try to use the emotional things where we talk about his feelings about the church and how learning that Joseph had multiple wives, how that made him feel. And then we try to do the intellectual where I ask him, how do you feel about Proposition 8? How do you feel about blacks in the priesthood? How do you feel about women in the church and things like that? But I don't know, I guess what I'm trying to ask, I'm not very articulate, is, first of all, what should I expect for what's the next phase so I can prepare myself? And how can I apply, like, these four intimacies to, us working together through it, if that makes sense?
As far as stages, the one thing that's, like, really great as far as stages is grief. Like, you pretty much open up any psychology book, and there's like the five stages of grief, you know, and that can be useful, and it can give you an idea of expectations. But I've never seen any book that say the five stages of marriage, one of the five stages of, you know. And so, so I do think that, yes, there is a certain process that happens, but where that road leads for different couples, for different individuals, is not always going to be necessarily the same. And so there is a level of ambiguity. This is a big word that we talked a lot about in my school. And people are naturally uncomfortable with ambiguity. We want to be in control. We want to know what to expect. And we want to know what's in our future. And so when all of that is kind of taken away from us, then all of a sudden we're in that fear-based mode, kind of like, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to expect. I don't know if my husband's going to do who knows what. If he can do this, what else can he do? I think you mentioned something like that. You know, if you can go down this road, what other roads could you go down that I'm not even aware of? So again, we have a false sense of security in our marriages sometimes, thinking, oh yeah, I know my partner. I know that we'll be pretty much okay. And then all of a sudden we're hit with something and all those conceptions are kind of lost. And so it is kind of, so I guess I don't have a great answer for that. Do you have...
I was going to say, you know, I know a few people who have gone through a crisis of faith. I was actually there when John was going through it too. And I think to the disbeliever, the process of losing your faith is a grieving process. I mean, I think that it was of high value to you and you're starting to let it go. And I think that most of the time what I've seen from talking to people is that the bargaining phase has happened before you're coming out and talking about openly about the way you feel, and that you're going to go through, you know, anger and eventually arrive in acceptance in a lot of the cases that I've been personally involved with. I know there are other cases to it, but for me it felt like it was a grieving process, and I felt like I went through those stages pretty textbook. And I know a lot of other people who would say the same thing.
And you are both grieving on a different level, you know, but what you're really grieving is kind of the lost idea of what you thought you were building together. So even though you may both be coming from it from a different perspective, you're really kind of grieving the same thing. Yeah.
I'd like to add a little perspective. I think that, you know, I always draw this parallel to the intellectual crisis of faith and the gay community, the homosexual community. And one of the things that Carolyn Pearson talks about in her book, No More Goodbyes, was about when her husband, you know, and her got a divorce, and he went into San Francisco and kind of lived downtown in San Francisco in the 70s, and how she was not crazy about the culture that her husband Gerald was thrown into. And I sometimes have tried to be an advocate in the ex-Mormon community for processing the anger, but then moving to a more constructive place. And I wish that there was more positive reinforcement in that regard in some of the disaffected Mormon communities to try and nurture a little bit more health, just what psychology and comfort sure. But so I want to say first off that the disbeliever, and I tried to talk about this in the last 3 hours, in the first 3 hours, you absolutely have to at some point do, as we talked about, have your life be about what you're going to be about, not about what you left behind. And so I do want to challenge the disbelievers to process, go through their stages, but then learn to define themselves not by what they were fooled or how they were misled or how they wasted their time, but like, what are they going to stand for now and what positive things are they going to do? I want to encourage that. But I also want to tell the believers that they can be an important factor in the constructive development of their disbelieving spouse. And I'll give you a positive example and a negative example. The negative example is comes from some reading of Terry Warner, who's a BYU professor who wrote a book called Bonds That Make Us Free. And he has this concept called collusion, which I don't know anything else to the book, but I remember this concept of collusion. And collusion sort of is like this. You know, the couple starts out, you know, the couple starts out in the same place, let's just say, in theory, no one's ever in the same place, but let's just say there's this continuum and the couple kind of starts out there. But then the husband starts feeling uncomfortable about the church, and let's say in this case it's the husband. And so the wife feels a little bit nervous. And so as the husband starts slackening his beliefs a little bit, well, the wife moves in this direction, and she starts becoming a little bit more conservative. And when he starts voicing his concerns, she starts developing this habit of reacting and trying to neutralize and counterbalance. And what they end up doing is just pushing each other in the opposite directions. And I've seen this happen to the point where, you know, the believing spouse is just unbearably orthodox, fundamentalist, insufferable. And the disbeliever is, I got him confused, and the disbeliever is just angry and bitter and resentful, and it's horrible. That's not the road to go down. There's another option, and it's one that my wife was very effective in using. When I turned to her and said, I'm not sure the church is what it claims to be, first she had the tears, but then she said, okay, John, I trust you. What do you want to do? And that, you would think I'd run and, okay, let's all resign. And no, I was like, okay, well, now you've given me that trust and responsibility. I want to honor and treasure that. I don't want to do anything rash that's going to destroy our family. So I'm going to take this more carefully because I see that you've trusted in me to kind of give me a journey. And I don't know if that's always possible. And sometimes maybe the disbelieving spouse won't honor that trust appropriately and they'll abuse it and misuse it. But I want to believe that if you can show that type of love and acceptance and confidence and trust, maybe there's a way that you can help them in their journey of healing and rebuilding instead of pushing them more and more in the direction. Though I don't want to ever blame the believer for any lack of constructive acts that the disbeliever may engage in. Does that make sense? And so that's a little bit. The other thing I'll just say is that I've seen people get stuck in disaffection for 5, 10, 20 years. It's not fun. And so, what comes after disaffection? It takes a strong person to rebuild and to start redefining their self-concept around other things than being an ex-Mormon or former Mormon or anti-Mormon. And so I think some of the things Natasha said are very effective. And I think the extent to which you guys are equally yoked at constructive activities, I want to discourage the disbeliever from this narcissistic thing that it's always got to be about their pain and journey. They're the only ones suffering. Let's talk about the church for 10 years straight every time we have a chance to talk. Let me dump on you all these historical things and problems that I have. You can make the other spouse just disappear as if their interests and concerns are just irrelevant because all that matters is your crisis of faith. And so I want to caution the disbelievers to realize that half of your, if it's going to be half, have half of your intellectual discussions be about the church, half of your emotional ones, and try to be proactively acknowledging that your believing spouse has her or his own interests and concerns and hobbies, and don't be so selfish and narcissistic that it's always got to be about you and your pain. Because I've seen marriages where the believing spouse is like, yeah, my husband told me that he can't be there for me because he's going through a crisis of faith. So I'm just kind of managing the children and finding other venues for my own emotional and spiritual and intellectual needs because my husband says he just can't be there for me right now. And I hope neither of you do that to each other, I guess. Holly, were you? Okay. Hey, Carl, sorry.
I think this discussion of the four intimacies is really good. What struck me in thinking about my own marriage is that, sometimes I think it's just good to focus on what's working and to maybe downplay the spiritual realm that's not working. And I think we forget that life is a broad kind of experience that includes a lot of different types of experiences, and we don't have to just focus, 100% of our attention on the spiritual area where it's not working.
Right along with that, I love that because I hear people saying all the time, we're so opposite. I guess we attracted each other because we're so opposite. We're just night and day. The fact is you're 95% like your spouse, but the 5% is what you notice because that's what bugs you. You wouldn't be with your spouse if you weren't pretty similar, especially maturity level-wise. You wouldn't have attracted them. You can only attract people that are kind of at your same level. But we start living and we start noticing the differences. And then all of a sudden, we kind of have this effect with differences when we have 95% of the things in common, and we've completely lost sight of that.
A couple things you said, John, I want to respond to. When you mentioned Carolyn Pearson talking in her book about how she was unhappy with where her husband went, what I remember is how jealous she was of the fact that he blossomed and that she just was stuck. And then the other thing, responding to her, you said, you know, make sure that at least half of what you talk about is not the church. At least half of what you talk about is something else. And I would say, make it more than that, please. And yes. And I actually have gotten to be so close to my nieces and nephews, because when I go home to family reunions and stuff, they're the only ones who don't talk about the church. I mean, there'll be these conversations where everybody's like, this is my calling and this is what I'm doing and blah, 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 and this is what I've talked. And so I'm like to my nephews, I'm like, so how's kindergarten? And they're the only ones who will actually have conversations with me that aren't about their callings or visiting teaching or something. And it's like, you know, I actually have some interesting ideas and I would like to talk about them sometime. And so, yeah, because everything you listed when up there was about the church. And, you know, go see a movie.
That's funny. Well, one of the things that I want to bring up, too, is that a lot of times people are wondering, are we going to be now compatible? In other words, is this a big enough deal in our lives that we're going to have to split over this? And that's something that comes up a lot. And so I have handouts that all these ideas are written down on, so you'll get one of those at the end if you want one. The number one book I recommend if you're considering divorce is called Divorce Besting by Michelle Weiner Davis, if I'm saying her name right. Because what I am always afraid of, I'm with John in that I think divorce many times can be a viable solution for all involved. On the other hand, I think divorce is a fantasy world. I think that we are in our pain, we are in our, you know, heartache, we're in our fear. And so divorce becomes kind of like a fantasy. Well, if I get divorced, this problem will go away. And if I get divorced, I'm not going to have to deal with this anymore. Well, that may be true if you don't have kids. And that might be, if you don't have children, it might be something to seriously consider. I do treat my couples without children different than my couples with children, because you're coming from a different framework. On the other hand, regardless of whether or not you have children, you are with this person for reasons that you're not always cognitively aware of. And what the research has shown is that many people who do divorce, if they don't deal with the reasons why they divorced, if they don't deal with their own stuff of why they attracted this person to begin with, they're finding themselves now in a repetitive pattern where they're attracting similar people, but now they have stepchildren involved, and things just become a lot more compromising, and the fantasy quickly fades, because now your life is more complicated. So I do always encourage couples that whether or not you think you need to divorce, do some marital work first. And even if it's just with the idea that I want to leave this marriage a decent human being without, you know, becoming an angry, bitter, backstabbing type of person, which many times in divorces that go ugly, it's amazing what people who have shared their bodies with each other will do to each other in a divorce situation. So I recommend that book. I think she has a lot of really great ideas and thoughts about what you can expect if you do get a divorce, what are going to be your challenges that way, and also if you want to try to save your marriage, what are some logistic ways of trying to do that. And a lot of what she talks about is this idea of self. And she has this fun chapter, it's called It Takes One to Tango. Like, I can tango by myself. I don't need you to tango. But I think there's great wisdom in that, because there's many times that I'll have a couple call me or a person will call me and say, I want desperately to get help, but my husband won't come in or my wife won't come in. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll do marital therapy with you. You know, and I still call it marital therapy because that's what they're wanting. And there's amazing things that you can do yourself to change the dance within your relationship. And one thing that we all just need to understand about changing a dance is that you're going to step on toes. And what happens when you step on toes? they're squawking. You know, so as long as you know all those things kind of going into it, you're not as shocked when these things kind of come up and people have, you know, little temper tantrums and stuff. But all that can be, you know, logistically overcome in most relationships. If you are having, if you do have children, whether or not you're going to divorce, you're going to have all the issues that we talked about earlier, you're still going to have them. And you're going to have them at a much more polarized way, because now you're going to have two homes that those kids have to visit, two sets of rules, lots less, if you think you want control and influence, lots less of that, because now they're with their dad or with their mom for weeks at a time without any influence from you. Again, they'll eat you alive if you and your wife or you and your husband don't have some type of, you know, united front. You still need the united front. So none of that escapes with a divorce. None of it. So that's just part of the fantasy that I hope I can just prick a bubble in that right away. Because if that's your reason for divorcing, is that I'm going to save the children and I'm going to not allow them to have any contact with their other parent, or lessen the influence of the other parent, you're actually kind of doing the reverse. They'll actually seek out that parent probably more. So just a thought for those of you that might be a consideration. Any questions about that or this book? Any other thoughts? Okay. The other book that I highly recommend is by John Gottman. It's called The 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work. And he is probably one of the most fascinating mental health people I know or have studied, because he's really hooking people up to electrodes and all kinds of stuff. He has a special, it's called the Love Lab. It's in Washington, Seattle. And he will hook you up to all these things so they can measure, you know, your blood pressure and your heart rate and all those kind of physiological responses. And then he just lets you loose in this apartment and you just live there for a few days with your spouse. And then and he studies you, you know, and I guess there's probably mirrors and he takes all these measurements. And so he's come up with a pretty bold claim, which is he can predict 91% of the time whether or not you're going to divorce. And a lot of that has to do with the ways that you're communicating. And so I'll just kind of review a few of those. The harsh startup. This is when you say to somebody, I can't believe you didn't do that again. Or I can't believe you're reading that stupid book about Joseph Smith again. I can't believe, you know, that's a harsh, like, you're automatically putting somebody on the defense. Automatically, no matter if it's about the dishes or church or whatever, you're automatically putting somebody on the defense. And when you put people on the defense, you're already in fight mode. Okay, so whatever you just wanted to get out of that statement that you made, you're probably not going to get. So you just kind of self-deprecated yourself. There's four, he calls them the four horsemen. They come in and they ruin your marriage. Criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. Criticism, I think we all know what that is. That doesn't mean that you can't have a complaint. Or you can say, I don't like it that you're now drinking wine, I'm really kind of not liking that. But when you say, you know, I can't believe you're drinking wine and you've just turned into a big alcoholic, now that's kind of more criticism. Okay, so now you're demonizing that person. Instead of just saying your complaint, which is, I'm not happy with this and I'm concerned and I have a legitimate concern here. You can have legitimate concerns and you can talk about them without being critical. Contempt is when you kind of put each other down. So like, oh, I can't, you know, you're the whole, like John was talking about, you're not enlightened, you don't want to do this journey with me, you're so stupid, or you're not willing to do this. Yeah, that's contempt. It's kind of looking down. I'm better than you somehow. Defensiveness is, of course, then when we defend ourselves because we're so angry about these things that are being said to us. And stonewalling is when you just kind of tune out. Like, I'm so tired of the constant criticism and contempt that I'm just going to not talk to you at all. So those, all of those things, and we all do them at different levels, but they're the enemies to your marriage. Your body language is very much a part of it. If you turn towards one another, if you're willing to look at each other, if you're willing to kind of stroke or just, you know, have some body contact when you talk, that can say a lot about a couple. When I have couples that come in and one sits on this end of the couch and one sits on this end of the couch, and they're both like this and like looking at me like they don't even want it. Whereas other couples kind of lounge down and, you know, one will have an arm on top of another. There's a whole different level of process going on already. Like, I already know a lot about that couple before they've even said what their problems are. Failed repair attempts. So in other words, a lot of times you bring up a complaint and the other person tries to repair it somehow. So they'll make a joke, or they'll try to make it light, or they'll try, but golly, no, I'm not going to take that joke. You're not taking me seriously. So that was an attempt at repairing whatever happened, but the other person said, no, I'm not having it. I'm not going to take your joke. I'm going to still stay mad about this. So not allowing for the repairing to happen. And then bad memories. So again, focusing on the negative. Like, well, he's done this to me all the time, when really maybe it's been 10 times, or she always does this. So when you focus on all the negative, you forget the positive about your relationship. The 7 principles that he talks about are enhancing your love maps, which your love map is all the different things that you know about that person. So do you know how that person's day went? Do you know what their favorite color is? Or what would they order at this restaurant? Or if you were going to bring them a birthday present, do you even know what they want or need at this time? You know, so just kind of, what are the different things about this person that are important to them at this time of their life? Nurturing your fondness and admiration, turning towards each other instead of away, so again, the body language. Letting your partner influence you, and this is interesting in this light, that it doesn't have to be so polarized, that maybe you can listen to some of the concerns of a non-believer. And maybe as a non-believer, you can listen to some of the beliefs that the believer still has and still find value in that. Let your partner influence you at some level. Solving problems, and he talks more about that, and then overcoming gridlock. And gridlock is when you're kind of doing this, like you're stuck right here. So how do you get back to kind of at least this? If not this, right? So those are kind of some of their the issues of both of these books that I recommend. A lot of this I've written down for you. Any questions so far? Do any of you want to admit to doing any of these things? Because I know I haven't. So I don't know what they're talking about. Yes.
What I'm wondering is, you know, I'm sure that I'm not the only one in the room who recognizes myself in some of the things you've been talking about. How do you really step back? They're habits. I mean, 21 years of habits. We have a very busy life. We have children. They have invaded our emotional space here. How do you even start to step back from all of that and create new habits of relating to each other in ways that are more positive?
Right. No, and that's a great question. Of course, that's what I spend hours of counseling.
You live in Kansas. It's probably not going to happen.
The what now?
We're not coming to Kansas.
Right. No, I know. And there's great therapists all over the world. And I do Skype sessions just by the way. But not to promote my field, but I do believe in my field. And I do think that sometimes if you get to a gridlock position, or even before you get to a gridlock position, it's good to get an objective person involved, because you don't want to get to a point where it's so awful that you have a hard time recovering, or that the trust is so broken that maybe divorce now is the only option. So, I mean, there is a place for counseling. But I do have some do's and don'ts that I'll go over that I think are important. Let me see if I can find those. Okay, relational processes that I think one wants to avoid in your specific situation. Provocative language. So lose the cult, lose the brainwashing, lose the, celestial kingdom material. Lose the provocative language. We can talk to each other without eliciting those defenses, because really those words carry a lot of baggage to them. They mean a lot. And when you throw them out there, it's very difficult for that other person to engage you in a conversation. You lose credibility in a way.
And the other words might be apostate or faithless, yeah, or not a worthy priesthood holder.
Yes.
On the other side.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I only gave my celestial marriage one on that one hand. So, yeah, thank you. The other thing to avoid is the what-ifs, because we don't really, the what-ifs are unknowns. And, again, they can turn into fantasies that you'll never see. So, in other words, well, if my husband had never left the church, our son surely would have gone on a mission. Or if my wife would have not, you know, joined this journey with me, our daughter wouldn't be having, you know, sexual promiscuity now, because in young women's they warped her brain, or, you know, whatever. So these are things that happen regardless of whether or not parents are in the church, out of the church. Kids join the church when they're 18 on their own. I mean, you have, again, these are the what ifs that you can spend a lot of time thinking about and wishing about and bring you no really peace or accord. And it just kind of continues that pattern of anger. Okay. Disrespect, we've talked about that, so believing the other is stupid or enlightened because of their views, and this goes on both ends. You know, I can't believe they think like this. So in other words, somehow I'm better. That's really what it's about. Somehow I'm better than this other person. And does that really fit into your core values, you know, on either side of the equation? I don't think it does. Trying to change the other's mind. And this is like, for those, I mean, we've all grown up in the faith, or at least have had some relationship with the faith. I mean, this is classic missionary stuff, right? Can you force anybody to have a testimony? Supposedly not, right? That's what we say anyway. Well, you can't force anybody not to have a testimony either. So it goes both ways. You can't really force your own opinions onto somebody else. You can talk about things. You can discuss things. You can come to agreements or disagreements or compromises. But your beliefs are your beliefs, and they're your own. Ongoing negative debate. So in other words, kind of like John said, if 90% of your dialogue together has to do with whether or not Joseph Smith was a prophet, you know, it's getting boring and tedious, and it's not helping you build up your other intimacies, and it's just not worth it. So, and I think the reason why we bring it up 90% of the time is because we're trying to convince the other person to think like us. So share it. I mean, you can talk about it every now and then, but I would like it to be more like a 20-80 type of thing. You know, we talk about it 20% of the time, especially after the main crisis is over. You know, I mean, maybe at first we're talking about it a lot because it's new information, but once you've already kind of been there, done that, we don't have to go there all the time. We just agree to disagree. Okay, using sex as a manipulation tool. This is a big one, because sex is part, although it's its own intimacy, it's very highly correlated, especially for women, with emotional intimacy. So if I'm hating you because you now just drank a wine bottle or whatever, probably my feeling for having sex with you has highly decreased. And vice versa. I mean, it can affect men too. This notion that men don't need emotional connection for sex is actually misguided. So, understand the physical intimacy. It's its own intimacy, and give it its own space. And I know that's hard sometimes when we're angry or upset or feeling belittled or in all these other areas, but let's try to separate that out as much as we can and never use it as a tool like, well, I'm not sleeping with you because of this, or I'm not sleeping with you because you're not going to church with me, or there's just nothing good that comes from that. Making quick, rash, or emotionally charged decisions. We talked about this, going slowly. Nothing needs to change overnight. Recruiting allies with friends or family. Big no-no. So in other words, you know, and it's a natural instinct when you're suffering to go to somebody sympathetic, like a family member or like a friend. And sometimes there is some space for that, but in a general rule, I discourage it, because usually, especially if you're going to stay together, then now these people have difficult feelings for your spouse, and you may work through those issues with your spouse, but now these people really don't work through those issues with your spouse. So now you've created a lot of triangles and difficult social situations. This is kind of where you have to be comfortable sitting with your own pain sometimes, in respect to the fact that you're married, and in respect to the fact that It's not everybody else's business what the two of you are going through. So if you need somebody to triangulate, that's what I'm here for. You triangulate with a therapist or somebody who's outside of the situation. And plus, a lot of times friends give very well-meaning advice, and it's many times awful advice. So, because they see you hurting and they want to save you from that hurt. Families and friends can give awful advice sometimes. If you're the one causing the renegotiation of the original marriage contract, whatever that contract is, you know, kind of the expectations you had, don't expect or insist on huge lifestyle changes right away. John talks about that too. This needs to be a process. You need to be patient. And, you know, don't, you know, well, you're not taking my children to the cult church anymore, you know. Or I mean, these are just not helpful ultimatums. Don't give ultimatums. Like, if you don't do this, then this. Most people want to eat their words later, you know, but then feel, then pride gets in the way, and we don't eat our words because we said it, and then we do things we didn't really intend to do. Ultimatums are just not very healthy usually. Okay, things to do is we want to rekindle our courtship, and this is an excellent opportunity to do that. A lot of times, as married people, we do take our marriages for granted. And we get busy with kids and life and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we kind of start, you know, waiting away from each other a little. So the dates and the weekend getaways, I recommend one or two of those a year. And I don't care if it's just at the local mogul hotel that costs $40. If you can get away and just, you know, really try to enjoy what it was about each other that attracted you to begin with, and focus on those things. Be actively and continually looking for the strengths. If you want to be negative oriented, you're going to have a negative oriented approach. If you're looking for the strengths and, hey, what's still good here and what can we still work on, you're going to be taking a path that's a lot happier. Work on yourself, because we need to be able to meet our own needs sometimes. Putting all of our needs on the shoulder of a spouse is never fair. And many of us, I think, have that idea of when we get married. I usually tell my couples, I want you guys to be two standing poles walking kind of in the similar direction, so that when one of you varies a little, the other one is still okay. A lot of people have the idea that marriage is like this. You're supposed to completely lean on each other, so that when one of you varies, the other one comes crashing down too. So there has to be some kind of level of, you know what, even if you're having your crisis, that doesn't mean I have to fall too. You know, we can have our own crises at different times of life and still kind of walk forward. Yes.
With that, like, visualization, that just brought to mind, and I don't know, we also listened to Lori and Dan on that podcast, and I guess my question is kind of for Dan, because my situation is similar to his, where my parents are converts and my activity in the church kind of fluctuated. So my husband, his dad's in the stake presidency, his whole family is related to Pioneers and they're really strong. And now I think I had that idea, that pole thing, leaning on each other, because I never really had a super strong testimony. I've been really passive about the church. So when he fell, I kind of felt like I started crying and freaking out too, not because I was upset, but because I was like, crap, I have to be the strong one in the church now. I don't want to be the strong one in the church now. He's supposed to be the strong one in the church. Right. So
you felt your role shifting,
yes,
all of a sudden.
And that was scaring me, because I, you know, I don't know what to do. My dad wasn't never a member, and it just really freaked me out. So I guess, and anyone else who has, you know, who may have similar situation like ours, like, how I feel kind of pressured not to make him active again, but I kind of feel like, well, maybe I should not be a member of the church anymore. Maybe I should follow in his footsteps. So I don't know.
I know what you feel like. It turned out to be, in the long run, a blessing for me, I think, because I coasted through a lot of my life not really taking responsibility for what my beliefs were. You know, I went out on a mission. I married in the temple. You know, I did all this stuff because I kind of saw the church as this good thing. You know, and in the podcast, you probably knew it, but my dad converted. My parents became a lot closer. So for me, it was this, you know, the church was this good influence in my family. And so when I left for mission, I didn't really have much of a traditional testimony. I just thought, it's a good place. Let me give this a try. And even though I had what I thought was maybe the roots of a traditional testimony, I just wasn't really that strong in it. And I coasted and I married this woman who was from a much more traditional family and upbringing, kind of thinking she would check my worst impulses and keep me with it. So when that happened, I'm like, okay, I can't do this. This is crazy. But in the long run, it made me take responsibility. What do I really believe? And what do I want to have as part of that? That's been good because I don't have, I can't make the excuses anymore. I can't say, well, I'm doing this for her. I'll give you one example. And I say this carefully because, especially because I've been billed as the believer. this is one way I stray a lot. I'm not a big fan of the temple. For many reasons, I won't go into them all. But I've never felt that kind of connection and never felt that that doesn't square with what ultimately my vision of God is. And so in most of my Mormon life, I think most of what I've done, I've been successful at doing not because of guilt. I've done most of my things because I think they're good things. You know, I think there's good reasons to do home teaching. I'm not a very traditional one, but, you know, going out and looking after, you know, my fellow ward members and seeing that they're okay, I can get behind. Service. So many of the Mormon practices that I do because I see the good in them. The temple was the one thing that when I did it, sporadically as I did, it was simply because, oh gosh, it's been a few years, I haven't gone, I better go. And so Laurie never pressured me this way at all. In fact, if I had a firm belief in attending the temple and wanted to do so every month, I have no doubt she'd be fine with that. But I sent, you know, a few years ago, I just came to the conclusion that it's not, that's not something that I need to stress about being a part, making part of my life. I'm okay leaving that aside. Maybe that makes me not a great Mormon. I don't know. I'm not going to really obsess about those kind of definitions. I'm just going to do what works for me and not do what doesn't. And so it's helped me to kind of restructure my own faith. It's non-Orthodox for sure, but it's mine. I own it. And it's a good feeling, but it takes a while to get there. So it doesn't happen overnight, but what I tell you is don't be afraid to look at the different components and, you know, customize what's going to work for you versus what's not going to. And you might find as you do that, you might have less pressure points as a couple because maybe there's just not as many things that you're going to have differences of opinion on.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that speaks to opportunity growth. You know, that we do rely sometimes too much and to the point that it's almost a crutch to us personally, for our own personal development. And sometimes it takes those fallings and those stumbles to understand, hey, how do I hold myself up? And if I can hold myself up and if I can have a direction and then I can look over and say, oh, hey, dude, I think, you know, I kind of want to walk this path with you. Instead of like, oh my gosh, if you're not right there the way I think, I can't even walk. You know, do you see the difference? And I think that it can bring a lot more intensity to the relationship when we look over and say, hey, I this is a path I want to walk with you because of you, not because of all my own crap that I've been relying on you to deal with for me. Does that make sense?
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.